Welcome to the Fat Emperor podcast. I'm your host, Ivor Cummins. Hey guys, vitamin D special today, and all the more important with our current viral issue continuing a lot longer than people expected. So today I have the pleasure and the honor of speaking to Dr. David Grimes. He's a giant in the world of vitamin D and health, been lecturing for a decade or more. So it's great to meet him. I have his book on my shelf. And Dr. David Anderson, who likewise has been researching and speaking on vitamin D and all of its health impacts for many years. So great to see you both today.
Hi.
Excellent. So I think David Anderson, that is, you sent a list by email of kind of your key topics and they resonated with me. So I think we'll just go straight into the action. A lot of people interested in vitamin D now around the world, a lot of awareness, and sadly, a lack of awareness from the authorities, the FDA, and myriad other bodies who actually almost fight against the idea of vitamin D being important, which has been quite stunning to me for many years.
Yes, I've been interested off and on in vitamin D since I worked at the Hammersmith Hospital, actually before then, way very early in my career, in the late 60s. And I was there, I actually tried to measure vitamin D, but didn't succeed, so I went on to something easier, that was testosterone. But at that time, vitamin D, first of all, it was 25-hydroxyvitamin D was discovered, and then shortly afterwards, the active form 125. And it was discovered as a hormone concerned with calcium metabolism. And the way that system works is the parathyroid glands monitor the ionized calcium in the blood, secrete their hormone, which acts on the kidney and promotes the secretion of 1,25-dihydroxy-D3, which then acts on the gut and on the bone and promotes calcium absorption. Now, I've come around to the view recently, but I don't think it's very popular, that this is actually an example of the endocrine system hijacking a much more primitive and basic system, which involves calcium control in cells. And I mention this because, unfortunately, in Britain, the D requirements are dictated by what I think is the greediest system, and that is the hormonal system. And if you measure, as Committee on Nutrition insists on doing, and NICE and all these other people, on saying, right, 400 units of D a day is what you need to stop getting rickets, then it's like looking, you've got a farmer with all his cows and a bull in the field, and he's got one water trough. And what he does is he measures the amount of water to go in the trough by the thirst of the greediest bull and forgets about all the cows. So what you have to do, what we've been trying to do, is persuade people that actually what you need to measure, and David Grimes is very keen on this, measure the vitamin D level in the blood and set it at something which will allow all of the other functions. There are many, many more that need vitamin D. And that means 30 to 60 nanograms per mil or 75 to 150 nanomoles per liter. This applies to all mammals. I mean, I've done a nice little calculation on mice requirements rather than NICE. And our laboratory mice are given as much vitamin D as they're given 6,000 units. If you scale up a mouse and you calculate for a 60 kilogram mouse, it works out as 6,000 units a day. So somewhere around 4,000 plus units per day is the right amount. But I just think it's an interesting concept that this business of us coming at systems from the endocrine point of view, and I'm a lifelong endocrinologist, we get it wrong because we forget about the more primitive systems.
Yeah, Absolutely, David. And I remember trying to simplify it for people a long time ago. And I just said, look, think of it logically without getting into the biochemistry. But there are many studies, including one where the rate limiting reaction of vitamin D, I think it was from another British professor, but it kind of levels off at 45 to 50 nanograms. So there's so many things that point to 45 or 50 nanograms. The ancestral black people, even with dark skin, but they're in the ancestral sun, they end up at 45 to 55 nanograms. A study on athletes in Wyoming who are out exercising healthy, obviously getting a lot of sun, 45 to 55 nanograms. And then on the dosage, around 5,000. And I always say 20 minutes in the sun, healthy sun, in a bathing suit, you're going to get maybe 20,000 units. So that kind of tells you what scale you should be taking in. But yeah, sorry.
Now, David Anderson came into this subject via the calcium metabolism side. And he and I worked together at the Manchester Royal Infirmary in the 1970s when David was in the calcium metabolism unit and I was working in the gastroenterology unit, and I became a gastroenterologist. And I came into vitamin D through Crohn's disease, a very nasty chronic disease, inflammatory disease that nobody understands, but it looked very much though it's due to some microorganism, which has not been identified with any certainty. But it's why people get it, and just trying to understand the concept of a long, prolonged inflammatory illness. And that's what brought me into vitamin D, really. And together with the fact that I worked in Blackburn with a very high Asian population. And why did they have such a serious health profile or a serious illness profile together with the general population in the northwest of England and the inner city areas like Blackburn? And I came round to the conclusion, it's all due to climate, it's due to vitamin D deficiency. So putting the two together, I realized the critical importance of vitamin D, and that was 30 years ago. So people can't understand now why I seem to know so much about vitamin D and immunity, and other people don't. And the answer is, I've got a 30-year lead on them. I'm in a very fortunate position. You know, the penny dropped a long time ago. But the important thing is that so much information has been gathered during the course of this year concerning vitamin D that it's impossible for people to absorb that information and put it into perspective. It's too big a subject for people to get their minds around it. Even the people at the Royal College of Physicians and NICE and all the rest of it, they can't sort of handle it. But a retrospective is going to be written about this pandemic, hopefully by David and I, and we'll then be able to put it all down. And this is the learning. What have we learned from this pandemic? And it will all be centered around vitamin D.
Excellent. And that's exactly what's needed. And hopefully many, many, corners of the world, people will similarly, because I find that like 40,000 publications, and that was around 6 weeks ago, I think, relating to SARS have come out. And the problem is we're bombarded with often junk science. I mean, people going over harebrained theories and finding mechanistic support. But here we have vitamin D. We have a bunch of associational studies in the first couple of months that showed an enormous connection between vitamin D levels in the blood and outcomes, not so much infection, but in actual outcomes, ICU and mortality. We have a huge amount of interest developing. And then sadly, the FDA, I think it was May or June, sent an injunction to a couple of websites talking about vitamin D and COVID, not actually selling products, but told them to take it down because it may be misinformation. So we have headwinds, but that's super. So I think we might go through now, I guess, some of the COVID and vitamin D data that you guys have been pouring through, and me to a lesser extent.
But clearly these two gentlemen are the experts in the vitamin D context. Yeah, just as anecdotal, I got involved, or my understanding of the importance of vitamin D arose about 10 years ago, I suppose, when I had a cancer research laboratory, and I came across a report, a study actually, of the incidence of prostate cancer in California. And one of its findings was that the incidence among golfers in the state was much less than in the male population at large. And that was put down to the higher level of serum vitamin D arising from their being so often and long in the sun. And that's when I first came across vitamin D. And then, of course, interest has been sparked with COVID. And then I can't remember how we got to know each other, David G and David A, but we have, and we've worked quite well together. But really, I think, Ivor, your podcast, it doesn't involve, it shouldn't involve a joiner up of dots like me, because you are the joiner up of dots par excellence. So,
well, I tell you, sorry, pleased to meet you, by the way, Chris. Yeah, I'm in such a habit of podcasting. When I saw you pop in, I just kept rolling, you know, and just to wait for a gap. And the other thing is, I can edit this afterwards. So even my comment there to, well, the Davids and yourself about getting straight into COVID, you know, I can edit out that comment suggesting we do that completely. And the thing maybe, I can't remember, David, your flow, but maybe the intention was to go into more general vitamin D for a while and then curl around to COVID. What do you think?
Can I just turning on to the question that relevance to COVID? When I was in Manchester, I mean, really, I took a senior lectureship there, the time that David is mentioning, and I had various interests, and one of which was vitamin D, but one of the bits of research that we did, I had a research fellow who was a Greek research fellow called Stavros Manolagas, and he and I worked and started looking for vitamin D receptors in fetal rat bone, and we found them. And, you know, we published a fairly mediocre paper, but we found in culture that they disappeared. And it was only when we put in glucocorticoids, of which the cortisol or dexamethasone, that we could retain the vitamin D receptors. And we published this. And this was probably the earliest indication of an interaction between glucocorticoids and vitamin D, which, of course, links in entirely with what we're finding now. And people say, wonder drug, dexamethasone. Well, maybe it's just acting because it's sustaining the vitamin D receptors and making the vitamin D protection against this virus more effective.
Yep, that's a very good point, because there's so many cross mechanisms here in this evolution-driven machine that is our body. Everything is connected to everything else. As you mentioned at the start about, you know, hijacking other molecules, different systems in the body. So there's so many potential mechanisms, but the problem is, I guess, that there's less interest in vitamin D generally in COVID, probably because it's not patentable and it doesn't have that kind of allure.
It might also be that it's actually too effective. I mean, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I'm just an awkward sod. But it so happens that many of these diseases that you read about, multiple sclerosis, neurological conditions, narcolepsy, Parkinson's disease, then we've got all the other conditions, cancers, we've got metabolic diseases, diabetes type 1, which is an autoimmune disease, diabetes type 2, which is different, but in a hypertension. All of these, there's a myriad of different disorders that are worse if you're D deficient, not to speak of all of the other evidence about viral and other infections, which we mentioned in our book, and which everyone became vitamin D replete, this might knock a big hole in big pharma. And
the only thing I question in all of what you said there, David, was the might bit at the end.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
The point is, we say might, the clues are all there. Yeah. It is just a matter, as Chris and yourself said, joining the dots together. And that's what people can't really do. They can't handle more than one dot at a time. Whereas if you want to join dots and draw a line, you've got to have at least two dots and handle them both at the same time. There are just so many dots. As you mentioned, Ivor, 44,000 papers, was it? Something like that? I know I've gathered 187 new papers during the course of this pandemic. And joining 187 dots together is a bit of a challenge.
Yeah, for sure. And in engineering, and I spent 30 years in complex problem solving, so it was actually all around that. And you're right, even amongst engineering people, you know, it sounds terrible. I've managed large teams, but and I've worked with a lot. But around 70% of engineers who would tend to be technical, around 70%, I generally feel they're more appropriate for project management, not so much hardcore problem solving. And then around 20% are pretty talented for that innately. And then around 10% are the people you need when you got a major issue and you heavily lean on them. So even amongst engineers, there's only a certain percentage that are really hot on dot joining and excellent at it. And we call it integration. And it's just hugely important.
But it's interesting that you say that, Ivor, because I've noticed in my communications with people like Chris during this pandemic, it's the non-medical doctors who seem to have the bigger vision and are able to join the dots better. But the medical doctors, they've just been so disappointing. Why is there so much ignorance to start with? And why is there so much of a problem in joining the dots, in integrating and learning from the knowledge that's been generated? Yeah, I think engineers have an advantage.
I think that since I haven't practiced medicine in Britain since 1991, because I then went and took a chair of medicine in Hong Kong and then went into private practice when that fell through. And I saw at that time, this is a time of the initial reorganization, that there was this inclination that things like NICE were created, which basically were intended that people practice medicine by numbers.
Yeah.
And so, and I think combine that with the fact that specialists, all the specialist education, all the testing that's done, you know, to find out whether someone should go on practicing, et cetera, they concentrate on their specialty. And there are big gaps between specialties, big holes there that you can fall through. And, you know, I found, for example, when I made a film on dog bites and rabies prevention, that an essential part of treatment of a dog bite victim is to inject rabies immunoglobulin into the wound. 3% of people were getting that in India. 3%. Eventually, about 20 years later, a publication I made has knocked a bit of sense into the WHO's recommendations. But, you know, this is monoclonal antibodies. That was the thing. That's what everyone wanted. Not polyclonal horses. Polyclonal horses are very, very cheap. You know, they're race horses. They don't mind being bled. They're bled and fed. They're fine. And you can purify rabies, you can purify equine immunoglobulin, no problem. And this was too cheap. Yeah. And WHO has taken an awful lot of persuading, thanks to someone in Shimla taking this on board and showing they could reduce the deaths from rabies to about 10% of dog bite victims. They were at last taking it on board. But there is this problem that this hyper-specialization and nobody giving any brownie points for connecting the dots.
Yeah, and it does a long history of that. And in Ireland, it's similar as well, and all over the world, and the American medical system. So there's kind of a fact, again, no conspiracy, but there's a medical industrial complex. It's been groomed for decades with pharma and everyone being highly supportive in education and many other facets. And well, here we are. So we'll, but circling back to the vitamin D then, you know, there's two sides to it in my mind, and they're hard to say exactly which one dominates more. And one is to simply get vitamin D3 supplements and raise your value, and that could be very effective. And then another way is to get metabolically healthy, cut out all the processed food, eat more meat, fish and eggs and real human foods, which admittedly will contain D, but by your metabolic health improving, the blood D level will actually come up higher in the test independently. So I guess the best thing to do is both. But there was a recent study from Spain, which I found striking. I'm sure you're aware of it. They used some form of vitamin D supplementation that was not the standard D3 you get in the pill boxes. But they showed like a 90% approximately in a randomized control trial with humans, 90% reduction of ICU admittance, severity, etc. And it was the most striking result for a single intervention, which was a form of a vitamin D supplementation, very high dose. Did you see that Spanish study?
Yeah, I'm well aware of that. It was in Cordoba, and they used calcifediol, which is the part activated form of vitamin D. When vitamin D comes into the body, it goes through the liver, whether it comes through the skin or through the mouth. It has to pass through the liver, where it's hydroxylated and converted into calcifediol, where it circulates. And that's the reserve in the blood, is in the bloodstream, is calcifediol. Now, if we were to take vitamin D as a single, fairly large dose, it might take up to 2 weeks for it all to be activated into calcifediol and to increase the blood levels. But if we take a calcifediol itself, it takes a couple of hours to reach the maximum blood levels. So if we give vitamin D to someone who's critically ill, it's not going to work. But if we give calcifediol, it is going to work. And the point is, the results in that study in Spain, which you mentioned, they've been so dramatically good that people just don't believe it. But they don't believe it because they don't understand the basic science that underpins it. It was, in fact, a 96% reduction in ITU admissions. And it effectively eliminated deaths as far as I was concerned. It's phenomenal. Now,
one of the problems is that with all these randomized controlled trials, that propensity to just accept that line of evidence, something that's really strong, which is the effect in the Cordoba case, as the study of the data from some mathematicians in MIT shows, it's a small study of 75 people, 50 getting calcifediol, which, by the way, that's the same as 25 hydroxy D that I mentioned, and it's the reserve form. It's not actually itself active. It's just the circulating body's reserve form. Anyway, that you know, and 25 didn't get it, and the ITU, I think, only one of the 50 went into ITU who'd been on calcifediol, and 13 out of 26 of the others. And the stats, it sounds a small trial, but then you've got, the stats are absolutely overwhelming. And of course it should be, of course, anybody going into ITU with COVID-19 should get that dose. It wasn't a big dose, actually. It was 20,000 units orally, you know, once, and then I think 3 days later, and overwhelming effect.
It has been criticized for being a small trial, but small trials, there's nothing wrong with them if they show big effects. We need large trials to show little effects and little benefits. But if it's a big benefit, a trial of 75 is fine. Now, since that trial was published on the 3rd of September, we've had 19,000 deaths from COVID-19 in the UK. Now, how many of those deaths could have been prevented if we'd accepted that trial and gone into and gone into giving calcifediol to people who are critically ill? Because all those 19,000 deaths, you went through a phase of being critically ill before they died. They could have had.
I think that a good to come back to Ivor's question about earlier question about the two different cases: the severe use for treatment and use for prevention. Now, prevention, I actually early in my get this coming to my attention, I realized in Italy you can buy vials of 100,000 units of vitamin D, which you can't get in the UK, only can you get in a prescription. In Italy, paradoxically, you can't get it on prescription, you can only go and buy it from the chemist. Anyway, I offered to send 1,200 vials to the Florence Nightgown Hospital, or Florence Nightingale Hospital in Manchester, to give to staff. One vial of 100,000 units would boost your level up to something reasonable for 2 to 3 months. And it was turned down by the ethics committee as being unethical to give staff who are going to be put into the front line a vitamin that it can do, couldn't possibly do you any harm. And then we moved later, I contacted Paraj Singhal, who's an excellent doctor and secretary of an Asian doctors association, BAPIO, that also has a number of, has a lot of African or a lot of African origin and other ethnic minority doctors, got a lot of members. And the message got out because it was obvious then that the deaths among healthcare workers in Britain, the deaths from COVID-19 were astronomically high in people with colored skin. And Paraj got this out to his members, and David Grimes has found that looking at the figures, the deaths dropped like a stone among medical profession in Britain, among Asian doctors.
I'll just emphasize that lockdown occurred in this country on the 23rd of March. Between the 23rd of March and the 3rd of May, that's just over a month, there were 25 doctors in this country, working doctors, died from COVID-19. And of those 25, 24 of them were of Black African or Asian ethnicity. Now, David and Paraj sent that note out and the vitamin D out on the 29th of April. 4 days later, a doctor in Ramsbottom died. GP in Ramsbottom died from COVID-19. After that, the deaths all stopped. There was this cluster of 25 deaths within a 5-week period, which stopped abruptly 3 days after this letter went out, telling everybody to take vitamin D, telling all these doctors to take vitamin D.
Illegally, I actually sent about 500 vials to Paraj. Which he distributed to make the point that if you're at risk, you need a high dose. You need to become a sudden, instantaneous lifeguard worker, in California, getting that sort of level of vitamin D, but to do it by mouth. So that I think was a very powerful example. But, Nice, Nasty, and the other organizations, the College of Physicians, these people, and the government, they wonder what it was about having a darker skin that made you more likely to get COVID-19 because your D levels are lower.
I know, and we saw that in America too, and it's hard to watch way back months ago. You're watching the coverage and it's so obvious, and like you say, 24 out of 25, and that takes out the kind of the whole societal there's obviously a correlation with societal level, financial and socioeconomic, because poorer people tend to have less good nutrition and maybe they drink and smoke more. So they kept trying to go there. But the medical professionals' numbers kind of put the lie to that, because you have medical doctors.
Yeah. They close their eyes to the doctors who died, because the doctors, they didn't live in small, overcrowded houses. They weren't socioeconomically deprived at all. They didn't fit in. They were the paradox which breaks the mold of the socioeconomic deprivation story. So what do? You change the story, or do you ignore the evidence? And the evidence was pushed aside.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ignoring the awkward is an absolute standard process, especially with the people. There's a cognitive dissonance that's enormous in medicine, and it's been cultivated for decades, as we mentioned earlier. I mean, the calcium scan I worked to promote for a long time, most doctors think, oh, that's not valuable. It's the most valuable tool almost you can get for heart disease prevention. But again, the business didn't like it 40 years ago, every aspect of the medical business, and therefore it was pushed against for 40 years. So what happens? The doctors all know that it's not useful. They don't know why they know. If you ask them, it's very entertaining. There's nothing there behind it. They just know. Yeah, well, they were just told. And you know, vitamin D has been told to doctors and in countless articles for decades, oh, it's not important and it's overblown and it's a fad. There has been a campaign against it, actually, pretty much in the medical.
Yeah.
So here we are.
Well, not only that, I don't know if either of the Davids mentioned it, but they mentioned it to me early on that the infamous Gates Foundation, in fact, will not fund any studies into vitamin D and immunity. So that basically proves the point, of course. Need we say more? Somehow or other, it has got to be brought out. There's a much bigger picture here that's got to be exposed. But softly, of course, vitamin D is very important, and so many people are now supplementing. You know, like you guys, we don't miss the opportunity to tell everybody we know about vitamin D, and they're all doing it. So, but it's important, particularly with this debate in Parliament coming up on the 14th of December about compulsory vaccination. Are you aware of that, Ivor?
Yeah, I'm quite aware, because I'm very engaged in the whole corona world for many months now. And it's stunning to see, because I always say I'm the opposite of anti-vax. And I give the anecdote, which is true. A few years ago, business in China, I had to get a couple of vaccinations. I didn't even ask what they were for. I just went down the dock and they slapped them in. So I don't have any of this fear, of implications. But at the same time, I'm a realist, I'm rational, I'm logical, and I'm scientific. So I look at this disease, its population fatality rates. We've had the first wave. The winter resurgence, we're curling over now pretty much. They're going to bring in a medication for kind of last year's, respiratory illness, because it's mostly passed through its main damage. And then for the first time, they're going to make it mandatory. But the number needed to treat, if you do widespread population deployment of that, the number needed to treat for a quality or quality adjusted life year saved, given the average age of the impacted people, I mean, it's probably 20 times higher than the NICE guidelines. They're 30 grand, I think, sterling per quality adjusted life year saved. This thing's going to be, I don't know, half a million if they want to make it mandatory. But they didn't even do that for the eradicable diseases like smallpox and measles. And yet for this, for last year's respiratory illness with a population fatality rate around 0.1, probably on average.
Yeah, that certainly needs to be brought out. And of course, so you do wonder where the agenda's coming from, but let's not go there. When the next coronavirus comes along, there'll be another bloody scramble for a disease-specific vaccine, whereas we've already got our innate vaccine, which if it's replete, vitamin D replete, we can combat just about every damn pathogen. It's not disease-specific, is our natural vaccine. So somehow or other, we've got to bring that out.
What you mentioned then, Chris, is if we're vitamin D replete. But how many people know what their blood levels of vitamin D are? Basically, as I said at the beginning, a blood level, about 40 nanograms per mil, 100 nanomoles per litre, seems about right. And if you have a blood level of 40 nanograms, you are not going to die from COVID-19.
Precisely.
Simple as that. Yeah.
I like that. It sounds like a very strong statement. But the reality is, from the associational studies, they simply can't really find people in the 40s, right, who have a severe or death. You can't really find them. And it's just stunning to see it. And yet, that's the very thing they don't want to talk about. So the doctors in America, I know, I have tweets and I put it in my, I did a few small 20-minute vitamin D awareness lectures in April and May this year, and then I had to move on. But, you know, they're not seeing anyone with a vitamin D in the 40s. And then you look at Japan, where one study of active elderly had 95% of these elderly women were over 30 nanogram, which is actually incredible. And Northern Italy, we know what happened there. It's the vitamin D black spot of Europe. And one study in elderly women there, 60 to 80 years old, I think 75% were below 12 nanogram, which is in the toilet. So you have this enormous difference between Japan and, say, Italy and Europe. And then people wonder, how did the Japanese not have an issue? You know, there were studies in Japan that showed a few hundred people right through the surge. They went up to nearly 50% antibody positive for SARS-CoV-2. So they actually got the virus in Japan, hand over fist. They just didn't really die from it.
Fascinating. I didn't know about the Japanese work there, but I've always suspected the Japanese people have high vitamin D, which is why they have a very healthy population overall.
I think particularly aged Japanese, so the new generation of Japanese, they're getting fat and diabetic and they're eating sugar, refined grains and seed oils, vegetable oils, junk food. So they have a problem, but they're young enough not to get hit. But if a country's aged, is health focused, eating fish and all and high vitamin D, and I believe the elderly Japanese are very targeted on supplements and on all this stuff, very focused on longevity. And look what it got them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Turning to your question about compulsory vaccination, I think it's very important to remind people that in the pandemic disaster, pandemics, the
swine flu,
swine flu vaccine by Smith Klein Beecham, of Barnard Castle fame, there was a nurse. There's the epidemic of narcolepsy. 700 young people developed narcolepsy. Now, narcolepsy is a very, I read up a bit about it. It's a very interesting sleep disorder, very disabling. And it's associated, there's at least one study showing that narcoleptic individuals have lower than normal vitamin D levels. Now, in that little epidemic of swine flu, which they tried to inflate as they've done with COVID-19, it was made compulsory for nurses in Britain, I understand, who were looking after flu patients to be immunized with pandemics. And there was one girl who developed severe narcolepsy, I've forgotten her name, a nurse, who committed suicide. She had such disabling narcolepsy and had been made, compelled by the nursing administration to take this vaccine. So that really is an example of just how dangerous it is. I want to just alert you to this book, which is China COVID-19. It's only available in Italian by a Joseph Tritto. And it's about the chimera which has changed the world. And the important thing here is he presents, I mean, it's a very well analyzed. I've read it twice and I'm I'm reading it a third time. And it shows quite clearly that this virus is a chimera. And the most dangerous part of the chimera is it's got a backbone from a horseshoe bat and the spike protein from a pangolin, which binds rather well to the human receptor, better than the horseshoe bat one does. And in the middle of this spike protein, there's a sequence of 12 bases that code for four amino acids, obviously, arginine XXXYYY, arginine, which happens to be the cleavage site for an intracellular enzyme called furin. And so once this virus gets into your cells, it'll continue to replicate without any of the normal COVID, normal mechanism needed to push it out again in capsule. I mean, it's absolute disaster. And there's a real risk of one of these 200 vaccines, and quite probably one of the three or four that are out already, being absolutely disastrous in certain individuals with certain propensities, because they've got different vitamin D receptors, they're vulnerable. And it's an outrage. And doing this on the back of, you said there's a second surge, but much of that surge is because of the totally invalid method for measuring the virus. PCR is not suitable. As Rainer Füllmich has said repeatedly, it's not suitable for, I mean, if you've got a cold or if you've got an acute infection, you'll come up positive. And that's, but taking normal people with no symptoms at all, you're going to get all sorts of false positives.
It's absurd. Our Irish doctors group.
I wonder, I mean, I think that nobody should have a vaccine unless they've made themselves vitamin D replete. So please, before you go and have a vaccine, your compulsory vaccine, will you please go along, take 100,000 units of vitamin D once or twice, make yourself D replete, and then it won't do you any harm. And actually, you won't need the vaccine because you're already, when you get COVID-19, you'll make it yourself. You'll make the antibody yourself.
We're into
what I've called Belindagate. Belindagate is the COVID equivalent of Watergate. There's a big scam going on here. It's a bit of a pun.
And it's very reminiscent of the swine flu scandal. And there's an excellent Spiegel article from 2010 that goes through that. And the amount of collusion between the WHO and around 30 senior pharma people who went to Germany, and they downgraded pandemic from having, major impacts. And they kind of took that clause out. So it just had to be a new virus that was kind of all over the place. And it was just stunning article, around 10 pages long. But also Sweden, the pandemic's vaccine scandal and the narcolepsy. I believe one of the early studies that identified that was actually done in Sweden, which might be another linkage to the present day. We saw how differently they behaved with this. But I think they saw 8 times more issues in vaccinated versus non-vaccinated with the pandemics vaccine, and they raised it initially, I think.
That was in Finland, I think, Ivor, actually.
Okay.
I think Sweden and Finland.
Very close.
Yeah. But of course, that is now kept under wraps as the pandemic disaster.
Yeah.
And its withdrawal from action. But at the moment, if that came into the public domain now, nobody would want the vaccine against COVID-19, understandably.
Well, that story, David, of the nurse, that story that you came up with of the nurse who had had that bad reaction and committed suicide, I mean, that would turn everybody off. maybe that needs to be written up. If you could do that, that would be very helpful.
I mean, I uncovered this, just doing a search on the internet. It's well documented.
I think it's out there. The challenge is the media won't cover it. So back in 2009, the media kind of resembled a real media. And there were lots of articles criticizing and challenging and arguing around the swine flu. But now look at us. No media will cover an article on issues with vaccines back in 2009, even though it's all on the record. There was a Channel 4 documentary. I often send the clip out from that. Lots of documentaries back then. It's all completely mainstream. It's all true, right? No problem. But anyone writing about that now will be perceived, right, as putting out kind of vaccine hesitancy type content. And, you know, there's this censorship unspoken across all the media we've seen the last few months. If you talk about herd immunity positively, it's highly frowned upon. If you talk about how the immune system works in a truthful way, that's actually frowned upon. You may get taken off YouTube. Professor Beda Stadler, the Fauci of Europe, the vaccine pope of Switzerland, he's an industry pro-vaccine guy, retired immunologist, emeritus professor, and he's been speaking out. And he told me in an interview that he's calling his students who are now in midlife in their careers and others, I call them all immunity deniers. Because the whole world of immunology is saying stuff that they have to know is incorrect, right? 0% of the population have immunity to this new virus. He said, that's untrue. It's completely ridiculous. But they kept saying it. So sorry, I'm ranting a bit. But yeah, we're living in a strange world. Indeed.
Well, do you know, it's very concerning. I came across a paper produced by someone who turns out to be a retired doctor who's based in Swansea. That's Rosemary Mason, who I sent the paper that she produced through. And she has done an expose, well referenced, which I'll send you, Ivor, because I do think somebody like you needs to get into this at the right time, because we are going into a world that seems to be one that is being pushed by a very wealthy private organization called Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, where our whole future health and nutrition will be based on vaccines, GM foods, and everything that goes with that. You know, quite a dystopian world. And I'll send you the paper that I found that she produced. It was on academia.edu, which you probably know about. There's thousands of useful papers on that.
Yeah, and I mean, I can link it down below afterwards as well. But yeah, I think, you know, everyone's getting accused of being a conspiracy theorist. But the problem is, I'm a corporate guy for 30 years, and I know the reality. Everything is business. You know, of course you're going to have a cover story. When we were making X product and it was kind of environmentally not ideal and we were making a massive amount of profit, we always had a story and advertising around it about how we were using recycled this and recycled that. They're the stories, just so stories. So we see that out of these organizations. Another one is the World Economic Forum, which is enormously influential. Again, super rich guys who want to execute a fourth industrial revolution and get us all, you know, into, well, it looks like hives and burrows and plastic money. We'll all be kind of, we'll get our shots and we'll all be nice consumers. But these are business organizations. There's no conspiracy. They're actually doing great long game programs. I mean, these guys, 10, 15 years, the swine flu didn't work out, but look where we are now. These are long game people at the top level of corporate and state interaction. There's no conspiracy. It's business.
Collusion rather than conspiracy, perhaps.
Well, and of course, in the past 10 years, that same foundation has got its tentacles into so many organs of the media, including, you know, The Guardian, National Public Radio in the United States, ABC News. Gates funds all their health reporting side. So, Christ, it is so very concerning.
BBC Science as well, I think, yeah. 60 million went their way. Imperial College London.
Yeah.
It's a couple of hundred million. IHME, which is the Imperial College kind of scaremongers or storm crows of America. They're funded as well to the hilt. So it's like every node of hysteria in this thing is getting money for a long time.
Yeah. Where Greeks bearing gifts, as they used to say.
Oh, which?
Where Greeks bearing gifts. Yeah.
I think George Orwell really understated the case in 1984, didn't he?
He did.
Yes, if only he were here now.
Oh,
but if there's one good thing that can come out of this pandemic and what we're talking about today, it is awareness of vitamin D and awareness of the dangers of deficiency and awareness of how common deficiency is. And what I would like to see is that when we, meaning, you know, the average bloke, go to see his family doctor once a year for his blood tests, vitamin D level is part of it. It should be routine. It's like testing for diabetes. It's like testing for blood pressure. It's like testing for all sorts of things. It's testing for a risk of illness. It's testing for vitamin D, a risk factor for illness, a major one. And if that were part of the annual check for the population, it would make us aware of how common it is. And I know when people have had the blood level checked recently, it's been a shock to them to realize how deficient they actually are. But yeah, they are deficient, as you say. So hardly anyone has a level above 40. And a man has
above 30 even, yeah. I would say, David.
Yeah.
Above
30. 40 is very safe. 30 is really safe. 40 is very safe.
No, there was There was a study in 2016. In fact, there were two studies on vitamin D deficiency. One was Europe-wide, and it has the title Vitamin D Deficiency in Europe, Stop a Pandemic? That's the European one. Yeah. And in the UK, it was carried out by the British Nutritional Survey, which is a branch of a government department. And again, it found that 21% of the general population had a level of less than 13.2 nanograms per milliliter. And that applied also, that level, to 75% of Asians. Mm. And then 63% of others and 50% of black. So it is a real problem. And these studies have been out there. They've been reported on, and as you were saying earlier, nothing has been done. So clearly, somebody is trying to prevent the human race knowing about their immune system. And I think we have a duty to make sure that that doesn't succeed.
Yes. If we want to test our personal immunity, the nearest we can get to it is checking our blood level of vitamin D.
Absolutely.
We can't test immunity in any other way, but it's a very good proxy measurement.
Well, you could catch COVID and see whether you die or not.
That's another one.
that's just to the audience that we're not recommending that. But absolutely, and you know, I know on the hour we have to curl to a close. But that's a great thing to stress at the end here. You know, we can go into all the science, and there's mountains out there, and you, David, have given fantastic talks. I still send the links to them. I've done a bunch. But yeah, it's this magic figure of 40 nanogram. And I agree that 30 nanogram is good for a modern person. But 40 nanogram or above, myself, my wife did not measure for 2 years. And then we randomly happened to get a blood test. I was 46, she was 44. You want to be in the mid 40s or above. Rough. And, you know, even in Africa, the Maasai study, they looked at the Maasai, men mid 40s, women mid 50s. And they're close genetic people, they're cousins, the Bantu. They're the same genetically, so no excuses. But they move to the city and they live in the cities and all. Modern processed foods, living in the cities, clothed. And they were generally coming in at 25. So you're having your evolutionary health status by moving to the cities and getting away from what made us supremely robust. So mid-40s, and I suppose 5,000 international units a day, if you're not getting much sun or in the winter in Europe, is probably a good guideline, you think?
Yeah. I think an average. I take a cracker vial of 100,000 units, shake it onto a bit of bread, soak it in, it's in olive oil. We have a lot of olive oil here. Soak it in some of that because it's a fat-soluble vitamin, and swallow it once a month, first of the month. And it's very easy because compliance is a problem if you're taking a capsule every day. So that's an alternative. I think the average, an average of 4,000 to 5,000 units, or around 3,000 to 5,000 units a day is fine. And I think it's easiest to maintain it throughout the year because it's almost impossible, unless somebody has put the wrong amount of vitamin D into the mixture in the first place. These are good firms that make vitamin D by and large. And one problem, of course, is that I think most of the vitamin D comes from China.
So
it's processed in China, I think you said, didn't you?
Yeah.
Probably the wool comes from Australia, probably.
Yeah. And you know, there is another I bought, it's expensive, imported from America, but the Spurti vitamin D lamp with 4 fluorescent tubes specifically for D. And Professor Hollick, you'll all know, he actually did a small human trial with the actual lamp. So it's one of the only fully regulated lamps, but it's around €600 to get it in Europe. But if people want to get it through the skin, supernatural, that's an alternative. But yeah, Europe in the winter, it's not good.
A packet of those, these are two preparations from Italy. One box, which is 100,000 units, that's one company, and this is another one. The annual cost of keeping yourself vitamin D replete for a year in this very simple way is €8 a year. Each vial works out at, I don't know, less than 50 or 50 centesimi. It's absolutely ridiculous. Yeah. No wonder Belinda is worried.
Yeah, and you know, I must get some of that actually, and I'll put a link to it. But it's Italy, it sounds like over the counter is where you get that.
Yeah, I mean, it's over the counter. Your doctor can't prescribe it. That's illegal. But you can be told to go and get it. And most people can afford to pay €8 a year.
Absolutely, but then to David's point,
you snap it open, shake it on a bit of bread, and there you are.
Oh, I see, yeah.
And I don't have any shares in them, but I do have quite a number of boxes.
Well, you know the point we'll end on, but I think we'll circle back in a few weeks as this thing develops, especially we talked about some controversial elements there 10 minutes ago. So we might circle back and see how things are doing in a few weeks. But this has been fantastic. And as David Grimes, that is, said, awareness, that's what it's all about. And this episode, you know, will just hopefully get more awareness. But we need everyone speaking up because otherwise the ultra rich guys get to win. And that's not in any of our interests.
Yeah.
Ivor, could I just say this? If you have any, you know, ideas, this upcoming debate in Parliament, you know, it's so important to try and get this information about vitamin D and immunity out. And, you know, it's not easy to get two MPs. They get thousands of emails every week. Email is not a very good way of communicating with MPs. Of course, they're not even in Parliament now because most of the time, you know, they're working from home.
Useless distancing. No, that's true, Chris. I'll certainly try, but the problem is the sheer overload. I'm caught in a battle in Ireland. I'm caught in so many things. Like, things are insane. But I think the best thing I can do is do short informative videos and then people can use them. But the problem is the politicians won't watch them. And I don't know how to reach them. I worked, what I did do, and sorry, I have a 12 o'clock meeting now. We'll have to go to in a moment. What I did do is I was working with two guys who were in the business community in the UK, and I produced some videos for them earlier, and they were getting politicians directly involved with their group. So I said, okay, I'll feed you some stuff, guys. But it takes British people to access British politicians.
Indeed.
Some Irish guy, forget about. That's the problem. But here, you know, we might do, just for the purposes of this recording, we might just go back where I said, you know, great stuff and awareness. And what? How did I end there where I can edit it, where we all just say goodbye? I just ended it with, so this has been great. Did I? I think I did.
Yes, you did.
Okay, so we'll just go from now. We'll all just say goodbye, great stuff, whatever.
Okay.
Goodbye, many thanks. Wonderful meeting. Thank
thanks
you.
A lot, guys, and okay. We'll circle back.
My best.
Bye.
And just a reminder that I do need support to continue putting together all of this content, and at patreon.com/IvorCummins or for PayPal at tinyurl.com/IvorCummins, where you can do a one-off or a monthly support. So I'd really appreciate that, guys, and keep me getting the science out there and countering perhaps the more biased corporate type science. Thank you.